Hello, my fine friends. Welcome back to Destination Discourse. I am your host, Stuart Butler, and I am joined today with Adam Stoker from The Brand Revolt. How are you, Adam Stoker from The Brand Revolt?
I am
it's not good.
I
messed it up. It's Brand Revolt. I'm sorry.
I was good up until you introduced me as a different company than my own.
Okay. Is there someone else called The Brand Revolt? Is that?
I have no idea.
Okay. You should have done some market research.
Yeah, our URL is thebrandrevolt.com.
Okay.
But we are Brand Revolt.
Okay.
And I understand that there's some confusion there because of the URL. So I'm going to give you a pass because it's only the seventh time on this show that you've done that. And once we get to 10, I'll start to hold you accountable for it.
Okay. It shouldn't have more than 8. I think I'm pretty good. Although I did call you guys Relic today. So I had to put some money in the swear jar.
Again.
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
what are you do? Are you guys going to get us a gift at the end of the year once that swear jar gets full? How's that working?
Well, we were going to throw a party, but right now there's like $3 in it. So I don't know that it's going to be.
And it's all from you.
Yeah. Yeah, probably so. But no. So it's just the two of us today, Adam.
Just us.
But I think this is going to be a good one because we come at this topic from two completely different perspectives. We're going to be talking about something that's very important to our industry. And you probably look at it completely differently than I do. And so, although I have a little insight because I used to be an evil vendor before I came over to the light side.
There it is.
So it's going to be good. We're going to be talking about RFPs and the whole procurement process and what we like about it, which is not a lot, but what we really don't like about it. And maybe we'll come up with some solutions and maybe a destination out there, some of our desties can get involved and share with us some things they've learned over the years and things that improve it. So that's going to be the topic, and it should be a good one. And I got my gloves on, man. I'm ready to joust a little bit, spar a little
Me
bit.
Me too.
Let's see
Me
see
too.
What happens. I'm feeling feisty today, Adam. So should be good.
Feisty Stuart is the best Stuart.
Yeah, yeah. It's certainly better than sleep deprived or hangry Stuart because those aren't great ones. Feisty is good. All right, but before we get into that, this is the greatest segment in all of entertainment. The one, the only, Stu's News. Let's go.
Are we doing the whole thing?
I'd rather you didn't.
I just feel like we've only done the second half for a while, so I think I'm going to stop it. I'm going to stop it at half.
I mean, the hook's the best bit, right?
Okay. We did it. That's good.
We did it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm hoping, you know, we're going to be doing a session at Esto on Destination Discourse Live, and I'm hoping we see some of our desties in the audience with their Stu's News t-shirts. I think
dancing,
you know,
dancing,
good.
Singing in the crowd.
We need to make sure we do play the jingle at some point during that session. Like, I mean, I think we'd be letting down our fans if we didn't. So
yeah, we have no choice. We have to.
Yeah. And talking to fans, so Stu's News today is a topic I wanted to talk about anyway, because it's very recent. Google had their I/O conference and this annual event where they sort of release some of their new things, and I think there's a lot of great stuff. Go research that. We don't have time to really dig into it in a Stu's News segment. Maybe it's a full episode later, but VO3 was the thing that everyone was talking about afterwards. So for those of you who don't know, this is their AI video generation tool version 3. A lot of upgrades. They fixed a lot of problems. The big one that people are talking about is the syncing of lips with voices. So they already did a good job creating voice and animation, but now they're synced. It's really getting to the point where the uncanny valley is getting smaller and smaller when it's an AI generated person. And I haven't played around with the tool yet, but I've been looking at a lot of the things people have created. And I got to tell you, man, we're getting closer and closer to this being a really viable tool that could have massive implications, not just to destinations, but for all people that are creating content. And so wanted to talk a little bit about that, but we'll frame it around a question that we got. So one of our desties left a comment on one of our Spotify episodes recently. So Adam, if you want to read that out.
Yeah, this is a repeat commenter here. So his name's Dustin Rowe. And Dustin, thank you for leaving this comment. You said, I'd love to hear a segment on AI gen video. Veo 3 from Google is going to be game changing for content creation. How do you feel about AI generated UGC?
Yeah. So I think we're at the point now. There's even some examples in their library of people that have created influencers or content creators that are posing as if they're real, talking about a destination. Like that seems like a good use case. Now, I think right now with Veo, and by the way, for those listening, when we say Veo, it's VEO, not just VO, just to clarify. That's their tool. But it's creating like 5 second snippets of stuff, right? Maybe 10. You can extend it a little bit. It gets a little broken beyond that. But I don't think we're at the point where we're creating 30-second commercials really well yet. Although you can stitch it together and it's getting really close, right? But the
Well,
com
for enterprise, they're
yeah.
allowing 30 seconds to a minute. And
Okay.
for the non-enterprise account, it's 8 seconds. Up to eight
Okay.
seconds is what you have.
Got it. Okay. So, and I don't know the pricing of that, but it's certainly something our team is going to experiment with. But I think we're probably, I think, 12 months away from being able to really create a good solid 30-second spot with AI, as a DMO without like a ton of video editing skills, right? I think we heard folks like the Russo brothers who do some of the Marvel movies. They said a year ago they felt like they could create a full 2-hour Marvel movie within the next 2 years using AI. So I think we're rapidly accelerating towards this place where we're going to have some decisions to make. And one of them is around this. It's not just UGC, it's about authenticity, right? It's about what are we willing to do. But you know, also what's my responsibility to my community? If I'm investing taxpayers' dollars to promote my destination, and now I can create something that used to cost me $200,000 to create a 30-second spot, like a high-end 30-second spot. If I can now create that at a vastly cheaper rate, but the quality's there, am I obliged to do that or not? So I think the UGC question is more about, you know, authenticity and being truthful in storytelling to our audience. So Adam, I'd love to hear your specific opinions on that.
Yeah, when it comes to UGC specifically, we are kind of nearing a fork in the road where, and I would like to pretend that we get to decide whether or not
You and me
UGC,
specifically, we decide for everyone.
we being marketers, really,
Okay.
because here's what's going to happen is the zone is about to be flooded with fake UGC, inauthentic content generated through some of these video models like Veo3. And if that actually works and it gets engagement and comments and shares and generates visitation, we don't have a choice as marketers because the market will have decided we're reacting to these videos. We're willing, even though it's AI, we're willing to take action based on these AI videos. And so, as much as I would like to pretend that our call for authenticity as marketers and our kind of purist approach to marketing is going to stop this wave, the only thing that will stop it is whether or not the consumer reacts. And so, my immediate reaction is I think it's going to be tested regardless of whether or not we believe it's the right thing. And those tests over the next 3 to 6 months are probably going to decide whether or not people are going to be actively using these videos for UGC, even though they're fake creators and all of this, because we don't get to decide. I guess that's my thesis here is the market decides, and you and I, we can make our best prediction, but it all depends on what the consumers are going to react to.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think there will be certainly people that go all in a way that's inauthentic and dishonest and manipulative. And you know, marketers, there's always bad actors, right? There's always a lot of the reasons some of the regulations related to spam and privacy and all this other stuff happen is because there are bad actors that are going to leverage any tool to their individual maximum benefit, right? And so I think that can work in the short term. For sure, for anyone, you can game a system, you can maximize it, you can go back to the days of SEO and black hat SEO where you would hide text at the bottom of the page, white text on a white background so no one could see it, right? So you can always find a way to game a system, but sooner or later, those things tend not to work. There might be some arbitrage where you gain early adopter advantage, but for me, what we try to do is say, we're trying to create a long-term, lasting, valuable relationship with our guests. You know, we're in a destination in Myrtle Beach where people will come back. If we get them once, we'll probably get them twice. If we can get them twice, they're going to come back year after year. We 2/3 of our visitors are repeat visitors. And so we're in a long-term relationship with these people. And so we don't want to do anything, you know, in the short term that benefits us, that hurts them or erodes the relationship. So, you know, we sort of look at things, look at the social contract we have with people. So right now, if I take a photo, would we use Photoshop to make the sky look a little bluer, right? Take out some clouds or the ocean a little bluer. Absolutely, we do that stuff. We don't feel like that's manipulating or being dishonest. That's putting our best foot forward and presenting us in the right light, right? So I think that's, we're comfortable doing that kind of thing. I think to fabricate what you have, so if we were to say, here's something Myrtle Beach has, we clearly don't have, because it would attract people, an experience of sorts. If we crossed that line and started sort of being dishonest and saying we have this thing that doesn't really exist, then people are going to come and get very disappointed. And long term, that erodes our relationship and the word of mouth value of that person. So we don't do this. So I think how we're going to approach things like UGC or chatbots or anything like that is we're going to be transparent with it. We're going to lean into it. We're going to differentiate it and say, you know, we're going to be in on the gag, if it were. So if it's a fake person talking about Myrtle Beach, we're going to make sure that we're signaling that it's a fake person and that that's clearly communicated to people, but have fun with it at the same time. So that person may can do things that other people can't. So I think if it's UGC, it gets tricky, right? Because if we're doing fake influencers, that's one thing. If I'm pretending there are real people that are coming that aren't real people, then I think that's sort of crossed a line, you know? So I don't personally see Myrtle Beach doing UGC per se, but I do think we'll probably end up doing fake influencers and content creators. But then I also sit back and say, well, where's the value in that? Because if I don't have an audience, then when I work with a content creator, part of why I work with a content creator is their creativity and their imagination and their unique perspective. But the other bigger part is that they have an audience that I want to reach. And so if I'm just creating content on my own, then I got to build my own audience. And so I don't know, you know, we're probably going to experiment with some stuff, but I don't think it's at the expense of these other things that are already working, if that makes sense.
Our duty as marketers is to test it and try it and look at the available tactics based on technology that are out there, right? I remember when the digital age just kind of started to come through, and you know, you see your first contextual search ads when you're looking for something, and it was like, oh my gosh, they retargeting was a great example, actually. That's one where it's like, holy crap, they're following me around, and so I feel like there's been these moments in technological evolution that have generated kind of a spectrum of reactions. Some people are really excited about it. Some people don't like it. And I think our duty as marketers is to try the new technology that comes out, test it and see what happens. And then if it benefits our community to continue to do it. That being said, I'm having a hard time imagining how fake UGC will benefit the community. You talked about long-term relationships with your audience at Myrtle Beach. And if you think about it, what you've been doing is you can have a one-to-one relationship with the audience, or you can use a mediator, which is a one-to-content creator-to-audience relationship, and leverage that to build the relationship with the audience. When that creator isn't the person in the middle and it's just a fake person, how authentic is the relationship between Myrtle Beach and the end user? And I have a hard time imagining that the audience will react well to that, but I think our duty is to test it.
Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't agree more, but to do it in an ethical way, you know, and really think about all the different things we've talked about. At the end of the day, you know, we believe that we should be obsessed with the customer, you know? And if we do that, if we're always obsessed with the customer, then typically we're going to make the right decision. And when we don't, we'll recognize it quickly and we'll adjust. So I agree, test it, you know, do it transparently and then see where it goes. But, you know, are people going to abuse this? And are we as consumers going to now get inundated with a ton of stuff we can't really trust? 100%. So I think there's also the opportunity, you know, where other people are going hard on this, you could take a firm stance on the other side and say, we're absolutely not going to do any of this stuff, and here's why. And you can sort of sit on that perch of authenticity and say, this is a guarantee to you guys. And there's some value in that. There's some utility in that. So I think there's going to be different approaches. Not any one is necessarily better than others, but I think the fact that you go in with your eyes open and have had these kind of conversations with your team and your board and your other stakeholders, I think is important. So.
I do think, and this is the last thing I'll say on it, this will benefit destinations that work with real content creators, because if content is about to be commoditized again at another level, a lot of these creators that have been kind of the only show in town and have continued to raise their prices and all this kind of stuff, I think they're going to have to be more competitive just with more availability from DMOs and other organizations. And so I do think it could benefit the budgets of destinations that this is coming out.
Oh yeah, no question. I mean, that's to me is the big opportunity in the short term is the efficiencies that we're finding through AI. You know, on a daily basis, we're finding ways that we can do more, and we're also seeing the impact of that in terms of the reduced friction in being a thought leader and being a content creator is already prevalent. You know, just look at LinkedIn, right? There's a lot of folks, including myself, that can now produce a lot more content because AI is helping, you know. And I think there's folks out there that are doing that I like to think I'm doing that in a way that's sort of I'm giving my personality and showing content that I'm influencing. But then you're seeing other folks out there that are just sort of churning out garbage surface level content that isn't really helping anyone and isn't really a reflection of their own opinions. And, you know, and it's just noise, you know. So we're going to see that on the video stuff side too.
Have you seen the new AI commenter tools that are out there that will scan LinkedIn for posts and put comments that are meant to look engaging and have a question at the end of them, but there's no human behind it and you can
Yeah,
tell?
and they're just trying to promote their whatever it is. We've gotten a couple of those on some of our posts, you know. So you know, we're going to have to become increasingly discerning and distrusting. I think that's the reality, and it's a shame, but I don't know that there's any alternative to that. You know, but filtering is going to become more important. You know, I think how we select what we want to pay attention to is going to be important. And there'll probably be a whole nother layer of AI that comes out for that side of it, right? It's like, here's all the noise. Let's aggregate this into stuff. And then over time, machine learning can pick up on what you like and what you don't and just get rid of the noise. So as a marketer, that also means it's going to be harder to reach an audience because the signal to noise ratio was just gone completely on the noise side. And so attention is going to be harder to get, but it is what it is. So I'd love for other people's feedback on this. What are you guys doing? You know, if you're interested in experimenting with video creation and UGC creation specifically, then let us know. We'd love to hear from you guys. You can always email me, stuart.butler@visitmontalbeach.com, or you can hit us both up on LinkedIn or leave comments in the show on Spotify. So let's jump into the topic. You know, I think this is going to be a fun one. So do you have a specific thesis around this? I think I do, but I'd love to hear if you have a thesis yourself.
And to give everybody some background, this is something Stuart and I have talked about a few different times off camera. And I just as we're talking about destination discourse, people are coming in with their kind of hot takes. And as someone who has been working as a vendor in the destination marketing space for 13 years, I just have to say it, that the procurement process in the destination marketing space, in my opinion, is completely broken. And the reason I think it's broken is because this process that's being used as gospel truth of how to find a vendor that's going to be right for the destination does not match the way to do it. I guess what I'm saying is, I think if you want the very best chance of making sure you find a partner that doesn't match the goals and incentives of a destination, go through today's current RFP process, because all of the incentives, and I'll talk through some of these as we go through the conversations, but I think all of the incentives based around RFPs don't match what the actual desired outcome is. And it results in misaligned expectations. It results in archaic approaches to new problems. And I actually think it sets everyone up, including the destination and the vendor, to fail. And I think it's something that needs a complete revamp.
Yeah, and so my thesis would be along the same line, and but where I'm at is it's kind of like that quote about democracy is the worst form of government except for all the other forms, you know, and I feel like this is the same way. It's like this is the worst form of procurement other than everything else everyone's ever tried, and so I don't know if we're going to get to the bottom of solutions today, but I think we can probably both from our specific vantage points articulate where some of the problems are. And I've got a couple of things we've done to try to improve it, but it's sort of iterative. It's not significant. So do you want to start out from the vendor perspective where the problems are?
Yeah, I can definitely do that. And I'll go through kind of a few components to paint the picture. As a vendor, I'll do it from my side. I get, gosh, at this point, I get at least an RFP a week from destinations who are looking for a new agency partner. And these RFPs, I read through them, and the number one issue I see is this RFP is a copy of another RFP that has a few edits and sometimes even has, like, I have read through RFPs that still have the wrong destination name in them because they copied another destination's RFP. And so the perception from my side is that every time there's an RFP that needs to happen, the person on the DMO side will reach out to their five closest friends in the industry and say, "Hey, can you send me your most recent RFP? I want to look at it and use it and Frankenstein an RFP together that I can use to find a new agency." And then they'll go through that using that as a base and try to make kind of the desired changes. But when the language that you're using from these other RFPs, or even from a standard procurement RFP that you get from your procurement department, is not conducive to what marketing success looks like. So I think even in the writing of the RFP, it does not set you up for success. And then the vendor receives these RFPs, and the vendor will spend dozens of combined man hours to create a response to this RFP. And every vendor is faced with a dilemma. Do I respond exactly as the RFP is written, which a lot of destinations, if you do not follow the exact requests of the archaically structured RFP, you'll be disqualified and thrown out as one of the finalists? Or do I challenge the RFP and say, "You're asking the wrong questions. Here's what we think you actually need," which is a much more risky thing. But then when you've got a bunch of non-marketers or non-destination marketers, board members, committee members, things like that, reviewing the RFP, they're not reviewing for the best ideas in a lot of cases. They're reviewing for the closest match to the incorrect document that was sent out to everyone to respond to. And so what you get is, okay, how good are these people at following instruction? That's the actual outcome that most people who are reviewing RFPs are reviewing for. And to be honest with you, if you're looking for a partner that's just going to follow instructions, you've already set it up to say, "Well, wait, what value am I getting from this agency because they're not bringing me new ideas?" Well, you didn't send the RFP asking for new ideas. You sent the RFP saying, "Can you follow my instructions?" So the dynamic that you're creating in the relationship is actually, I'm going to be the order giver. you're going to be the order taker, and then you're going to ask questions about why we're not getting fresh, new, authentic ideas from the agency. If you really wanted to set it up and get an agency that's going to think through how to look at the ever-evolving nature of things and continue to test and create, your RFP has to reflect that. And I haven't seen an RFP yet that actually sets the relationship up the way it should be set up.
Yeah. I mean, I think you make a good point. I think, do you currently, how you said dozens of hours, like on average, how much labor goes into an RFP response
Well,
for you
that's
guys?
changing with AI, right? And so I would say that 2 years ago, some of the big RFPs we would receive, we really wanted to give it our best go. And so we would put a combined 100 hours across the organization into responding, including spec work and things like that, into some of these RFPs.
And what do you think is like an average, or from your perspective, or if you don't want to give your specific, what do you think is so an average success rate of RFP submission to actually landing the gig?
Let's
Is it in
put it
single
this way.
digits?
Oh, it's way below single digit. I mean, we're talking 1 to 5% is the winning rate on these
And
RFPs.
do you get through, because a lot of them will be in rounds, right? There'll be like an initial submission and then like a maybe a Zoom call and then maybe an in-person. Are you finding that you're getting through first step, second step?
Yeah, in a lot of cases we'll be a finalist. But I think this kind of, with the incentive structure that's out there for the way these RFPs are built, the safe choice when you're dealing with the top three, you've probably got one that submitted a radical idea, you've probably got one that was middle of the road, and one that was really safe. And these committees, especially when you've got committees with varying incentives, varying opinions, the safe choice 90% of the time is the choice that's made, and that's usually going to be the agency that has 170 destinations that they work with and can demonstrate this long-standing track record of old tactics to solve today's problems.
So it's certainly broken. I also think it's disadvantaged to a smaller agency, especially a newer smaller agency, right? There's a massive disadvantage there. So let me set the table from the DMO perspective, right? So we take like fairness very, very seriously, right? We have to. And so I think we're sort of forced to incorporate our stakeholders in the process for
Define fairness
transparency.
for me.
Well, to make sure there's no nepotism going on, to make sure that we're rigorous in vetting, that there's opportunity for different agencies, non-incumbents, to have a shot at it, right? I think increasingly some folks would argue that there's a case for making sure there's diversity of provider and stuff like that, right? So I think there's a lot of things that are rolled up into fairness. But at the end of the day, it's making sure that the people that are making the decision are making the best decision for the organization. Not the most convenient decision for them, not the one because it's their buddy or anything like that, but it's ultimately going to be the best investment for the community's dollars. So I think that's why that it's set up in a certain way. That's why it's set up so the RFP process has like scoring and things like that, and unilateral scoring across the board. So when we do it, I'll talk about our process a little bit. Regardless of the department, it runs through our admin department. Our admin department issues RFPs, and you could argue the merits for and against that. It is a standard template. It is a Mad Libs, if you will, where you fill in the requirements. And then we set a predetermined scoring system based on what we value most, but we try to be spread that out from everything from price to relationship fit to did they answer the questions right? And the admin will sort of facilitate it, but then we have usually a task force of minority employees, majority board members, or stakeholders. So let's say it's seven people on a task force. If it's a big RFP, be three employees, four usually board members. So that it gives the board confidence that we're operating above board and doing the right things. But one of the things we do right now, and it's something I've only recently been toying with, is the scoring criteria for both cohorts is the same. And I don't know that that makes sense anymore, you know, because to your point, these folks that are sitting there that aren't marketers, right, that don't really know the nitty-gritty, why are they scoring how effective someone's going to be at doing a marketing job when they really don't have a way to do that? So this is sort of occurring to me. I've thought about it a little bit. This is occurring to me a little bit in real time. What if we sort of had an aggregate score, but the criteria is different depending on your role on that task force? That's something I might actually start introducing. But then from my perspective, the problem is it's really hard to articulate in a one-to-many way what it is I need, what the solution is. So we sort of forced into this boiling it down into the what it is, not the why, not the how. Like, you know, so we're sort of boiling down the essence to a point that it's almost not relevant to what we're actually trying to accomplish. And then we put it out there, and then it's grueling, right? The RFP process from our perspective is grueling. If you know, you could go invite only. But then you're eliminating people and you're not
And then that
looking at
fairness
everything.
issue
And that
comes
fairness
in, right?
goes, right? So you open it up to everyone. I mean, for the last couple of RFPs we've done, we've gotten 20, 30 responses. You know, everyone wants to work with Myrtle Beach because we're awesome. And so when you've got like 400 page responses and you've got to read through 30 of them and really give them the right look, that takes hours and hours just to do your first drive to pass, right? So that's broken. So I'm thinking now, like, is there a way to short circuit that a little bit, right? Is because what I don't want to happen is agencies start to use AI to generate it, and then we start to use AI to analyze it, right? Because that's where you could see it going. So we one of the things we did do recently is we started saying you cannot go over this many pages. Like
I like
deliberately
that.
put the restriction on it so people can't just waffle aimlessly. Like they have to be really specific and precise. We've also started doing phases, you know. So phase one is more qualification. Like, so some of the block and tackle stuff that the board's going to care about is going to be phase one. And then if you meet our criteria, then you get invited to phase two. And then we sort of narrow it down to the actual. So you're not spending as much time doing all the creative work, and we're not having to spend time reading through a bunch of stuff that isn't going to ultimately work for us. So I think breaking an RFP into components like that, stages, I think can help.
Can I ask you a question on that specifically, just real quick? So would it make sense for every RFP to just have a document first before you can even get the remainder of the RFP that says, do you have this many employees? Do you have offices in these locations? Whatever it is, right? Like whatever that criteria is that your board is looking for, and the signature on the other side says, I attest that we meet this criteria.
Yes. And
And
then
then
if
you
you
can get
do,
the
then you get
RFP.
the RFP. Yeah, I think that's something we've started doing more.
That is immediately such a win-win for both sides, because then it's like, okay, I'm not going to waste any of my time. I don't meet your criteria. Dozens of hours saved for me.
It is, right?
And for you.
No one's wasting any time. I think deciding on what that criteria is important, though, because I think generally speaking, I want confidence that it's in the Goldilocks size, right? It's not too big, it's not too small, it's the right size of team. But I also want innovation, right? I also want, and sometimes the smaller companies bring innovation that the big companies don't always, right? So there's a balance there, but I think you can decide on certain criteria. And that might be that I'm not willing to take a risk on a source of business this big for someone that's less than a couple of years old, right? It could be stuff like that. But then I think if you're going to do that, you have to find a conduit to experiment and pilot projects with smaller companies. Because one, I think you want to help breathe life into that ecosystem and bring new guys up a little bit. But two, I think you can get more innovation that way. But I think deciding as a policy that you don't have to RFP everything, that certain scale projects don't have to go through that whole procurement process, that we can run on the fly a little more test and learn. I think that's important. My biggest pet peeve in RFPs, I think we've solved it though, is historically people would bring in their A-list talent to do the dog and pony show, right? And they would wow you and they would be spectacular and they would be the smartest people you've ever met. And you get really excited about all the vision and the creativity in the room and you build great relationships and then you sign them and then all of those people disappear because they're working on the next RFP and you get given the cheapest or the newest or the rookies on your account, right? Because there's an incentive for agencies to sell their best and to provide their cheapest. They're going to make more money that way. But it never works long term. And that's why I think a lot of agencies have so much churn. Like a lot of agencies have so much client churn. And so what we've started doing, and I think this is effective, is in the RFP, we specifically say, when you present, the person leading the account has to be the primary lead on the thing. And the others, only people that can talk in the presentation are people that will be working on our account on a daily basis. And it's a game changer. It's a fundamental game changer. So I would encourage everyone to do that.
I like that. I like that a lot. I think there's a couple things that I would say that I think could really simplify this process. I guess I'll start with the issue and then what I think the solution is. One of the issues is, especially the stakeholders that are going to be there as part of the committee or whatever, if they're hoteliers, they're going to say, okay, what's going to get me the most hotel rooms, you know, booked? And same with restaurateurs, what's going to keep me busy or whatever? Well, you've got a long-term vision for the organization, for the destination, right? And sometimes what's going to work over the next 6 months, we know that it might be diminishing over the next 6 years, right? And so what I would recommend is instead of having the short-term view on an RFP of like, okay, this person can get me this result right now, even though it doesn't match up with our long-term vision in some way, shape, or form, I think an RFP, instead of saying I need earned media that's going to include press releases and events and this and that and fam tours and travel writers and like a lot of RFPs will kind of spell that out. Or on the marketing side, I want Google ads and I want Facebook ads, Instagram, all that kind of stuff. How about instead it just says, I have this problem, I have this budget, how would you solve it?
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I think that's good because that is one of the problems with RFPs is you're seeing how good a company is at responding to an RFP. You're not really seeing how good they are doing a job, you know? So part of me always also wonders if you could just sort of do some like dating with people, with different companies.
Yes.
And say, hey, I've got this problem. I'm going to give a little piece to three or four different agencies and see how they do. And we're going to work together for 6 months. And then we're going to decide based on the relationship, based on the results, which one is.
I don't even think you need 6 months. I think you could literally say, listen, we're going to give our three finalists a $10,000 project.
Yeah.
And if that project goes well, here's the business that's on the other side. Now I have revenue against the hours that are going against it. You're not seeing how good I am at designing a PDF. You're actually seeing how well do our two teams work together and the nitty-gritty of everything from the account manager to the creative team to whoever's involved, right? And you have a vision actually for what the dynamic between the two organizations is going to be for the future. Mm-hmm. In my perfect world, that's what it looks like. If I make it as a finalist, I get the opportunity to prove that we're a good partner. And I think every vendor would appreciate that. And every marketing team who has to work with the agency that the senior brass selected will appreciate that more too, because they actually get to see what it would be like on a daily basis.
Yeah. So I'm going to put on my Adam Stoker hat here a little bit and sort of push back a little bit. So if I'm a small agency or a small DMO or even a big DMO, right? My limited resource is time. Like that's always the limited resource. Doesn't matter if you've got one employee in marketing, half an employee in marketing, or 10 employees in marketing. It doesn't matter. Time is your limitation. And so the thought of me now having to onboard and work with three or four different new vendors at the same time scares me a lot. And so you'd have to set it up in a way that these folks can get what they need from me, but without bogging me down on the day-to-day basis, you know. So the projects would be have to be the right type of projects, right?
But what's more valuable or invaluable? Wasted time over 3 months or a bad relationship over 2 years, right?
It
Like that's.
depends on what the opportunity cost is. Yeah, you're right. I mean, if we're taking a long term, it's worth the investment in the short term, right? But the day-to-day reality is, we had this conversation today with our team. It's like, I need us to go 100% on this thing. And they're like, well, I can, but I'm going to need to go less percent on some other things. So you tell me which ones I'm going to take my foot on. So there's always a opportunity cost. But I do kind of like the framework. I think it's interesting. You know, when we did our website RFP 3 or 4 years ago now, we actually didn't put out a website RFP. We broke it down and said, here's what we're eventually going to do, but that'll be phase, I forget if we did two or three phases, but we said phase one is going to be who's going to sit down with us and plan out the scope of the next website for us. And if you do that well, you know, that's a much smaller thing to bite off than the full website redevelopment, right? But if you help us plan a really great website, then you're probably going to get the gig, right? And we end up going with Miles, and they did a good job with the planning, and they ultimately got the execution job. But we didn't commit to that upfront because we wanted to see if that was going to work. And really, we selected them because of philosophy. The way they saw the future of the website was the same way we saw it. And I think that's as important as the mechanics of checking a box and seeing if you can accomplish the work. If we're philosophically aligned, we're much more likely to be successful in the long run.
You got a date before you get married. I
100%.
and I mean, I don't know. I think this is one of the only places in the world, especially we're talking, you know, for you guys, we're talking seven figures on the line with relationships with vendors. For smaller DMOs, even though the numbers may be smaller, the percentages may be bigger when they're working with a vendor like this. And yet we're saying, before we even get a chance to get to know each other, work together, see what the dynamic will be, we're going to get into a 2-year contract. And I don't know, that scares me.
And I do like the idea of dating. I think it's going to take a shift because we've typically said, and I've seen this, I was on the vendor side for a long time, and I responded to a lot of RFPs, and sometimes they were asking us to do a lot of the work for the RFP, like come up with creative campaigns for this problem or whatever. And we would put our creative resources in and go and pitch it and then not get the job. And then 6 months later, we saw they're doing something very similar to what we pitched them, but with another vendor. Like, we didn't get any credit for that or any monetary benefit from that. And so there's also that disincentive from the agency to, or at least the conundrum of, do I give them, show them everything, or do I hold a little bit back in case I don't get it? Right. So nothing about this structure right now is working for either side, right? And if you see this differently, if someone wants to come on the show and argue that RFPs are perfect and there's no problem, I'd love to hear that perspective. But I doubt there are people out there like that. But I be prepared to admit I'm wrong. But I'd love to also hear from other people. What are they doing to fix it? But I think we've identified a few really simple things you can do here today. And some we're already doing. Some I hadn't even thought about until today. But I think doing different scoring systems based on your knowledge and your role on the task force is something we're definitely I'm gonna go talk to our admin about that in a second, because I think as long as you can agree on the framework going into it, then it's fair and you're accomplishing what you want to accomplish without sacrificing someone not having the knowledge to be able to fairly judge something. So I think that's one. Asking your vendor to provide the resources that will work on your account, I think that's another one. Giving opportunities for small successes through pilot programs, things like that, breaking down the thing. Like, those three things alone would be, I think, significantly improve the situation. So.
I would say also unstructure your RFP a little bit. Like there's so much of the what we want because you want to compare apples to apples, I think. But what you do is you basically prescribe out the creativity. And what results is you get the plan you asked for. And especially if we're talking a media plan, you know, you get a really tactical response. Whereas I think if you articulate vision, this is where we're trying to go as an organization. This is the problem we need solved. That should be like a 1.5, 2-page, 8.5 by 11 document that the agency can then go. And I like your idea of putting a limit on the length of the RFP, Stuart, because otherwise you're going to get just these wild, long responses that are unnecessary for both sides. But let's say you put
Written
like,
in AI with no meaning or flow, you know.
exactly. And so instead, if I can come back and say, this is exactly how we would solve the problem aligned with your vision, I think it would be that's a much better conversation starter than here's what our margin will be on Google Ads, and here's what our margin will be on Instagram ads, and so on and so forth. And it's like we're not even having an intelligent conversation at that point.
Right. So I think, you know, if we looked at it slightly different, so the prerequisite of here's the prerequisite information we need to compare you on to make sure you qualify, right? And then we can do an apples to apples comparison. I think that's good. But then there's a minimal piece, which is them working in isolation and submitting something to us. Where I would get more value is you articulating sort of your broad perspective. And then me, if I agree with that perspective or it's aligned with us, then I want to have conversations about it. I don't want to read documents about it because I want to poke and ask questions. So maybe that's the other piece of this is
Yeah,
you
should it
break
be
it up into
video
steps, right?
instead of
Yeah.
just written?
Or we jump to the interview process earlier, and it's not just a 30-minute interview, right? We actually spend some time really getting to date each other, to use your analogy, and we really get to understand the ins and outs behind what the thoughts are. I kind of like this. I'm actually, you got me excited about RFPs again. So
Never thought I could do
no, for
it.
sure. But I would love to hear other perspectives on this from vendors and stuff. I mean, we're forced to do RFPs in a lot of, it's not ideal. But I do think it's the, like I said at the beginning, democracy is the worst form of government. It's just better than everything else. I think RFPs are the same. Like, I don't know that you could eliminate RFPs from us if we're being good stewards of our taxpayers' dollars. I think that you could get sideways really quick and you lose the protection of the organization that way.
I agree with that. I think the process needs to evolve, and I'll just kind of wrap with this for the destination marketing space. The vendors in the industry, especially with some of the things that have changed, like ARPA funding drying up and the venture funding for a lot of these venture-backed organizations, it's harder to get funding than it was in the past. I think vendors are the primary source of innovation in our space just because of the structure of DMOs, how as quasi-government organizations, it's really hard to have a massive R&D budget and things like that. And so innovation needs to come from the vendors, and vendors are struggling. I talk to vendors all the time, and across the board, I can tell you that a lot of the vendors in the industry are struggling. And the idea of continuing to spend dozens and dozens of combined hours on RFP responses when the system is broken, I think it's a very difficult ask if we want to continue to have the vendors that have innovated in our space continue to innovate and invest in our space. And I think the dynamic between vendors and agencies needs a little evolution, just like everything else is evolving now.
Well, so just don't respond to one of the RFPs this year. Spend that time creating templates for the perfect RFP and then put that out publicly on, I don't know, a place like Tourism IQ, and then see if you can get DI and others to start promoting the fact that here's a standardized template for RFPs that fixes a lot of the problems. I think if you had the right coalition of people, you could probably get some momentum behind that, you know? So. But I agree. I think
I
it has
like
to come
that.
with the benefit. I could sit down and redesign the RFP process from scratch, but then I would want to probably selfishly keep that to myself. And there's not really an incentive for me to share that with necessarily with everyone else. But I probably would because I'm, you know, I do things like this show, which are not entirely in my own interest. So, but there's probably not a DMO that's going to take the lead on that, other than to look at it from their own perspective. So, yeah, go do it, Adam. Go fix the RFP problem.
We're going to work on it.
Yeah. You know, now my brain's running. I'm like, nah, I kind of want to do it too, though. So I don't know. Maybe you come up with your own version, I'll come up with my own, and then we'll have people vote on it. How about
How
that?
about you do it and I'll just present it as my own? Does that work?
Well, I mean, that's basically what you do with this show. So,
Oh. Very well done. Very well done.
Awesome. Man, it's that time. But I appreciate this conversation. It's good. You've actually like we talk a lot about this show being a love letter to the industry, and we want to be better tomorrow than we were today. But I got to tell you, there's often, and this is one where I'm learning on the fly, and I'm a better CMO for being a participant in this show. So hopefully our audiences are also feeling that benefit. And everyone that's listened to this today, hopefully the next RFP they do will be slightly less bothersome than it was previously. So
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, you mentioned it's a love letter to the industry. This is where I want to spend my next 30 years, and I know there's a lot of vendors that feel that way, and I would love to see us be able
You're going
to.
to work till you're 90? That's pretty impressive, man.
I'm going to work till I'm 110, Stuart.
I just made a joke saying you were old, and you just doubled down and said you're actually older. I guess it
I'm
was a math joke.
75 right now. I look great.
Yeah, well, we've lost it, man. If they want to find out more about you or ask you questions or invite you to do an RFP, where can they do that?
Yeah, hit me on LinkedIn, Adam Stoker, or on Tourism IQ, and you can email me at adam@thebrandrevolt.com. We're not the Brand Revolt, we're Brand Revolt, but our
Yeah, get it
URL
right,
is
everyone.
The
Come
Brand
on.
Revolt.
Get it right, people. I mean, I can't believe there's still people that are calling you the Brand Revolt.
Right? It's crazy.
It's unacceptable. If you want to reach out to me, stuart.butler@visitmuntlebeach.com, or you can hit me up on LinkedIn. And I'll be honest, Adam, I put out a post recently asking people to send us ideas for future episodes. I got a bunch. So we're going to have a lot in the hopper. Now, I will say it was mostly from vendors, the evil side of the industry that, maybe have a little incentive in there, but we're going to make sure we keep them honest, and this is not ever going to be a sales pitch. We want this to be real dialogue with real people and really invite the folks that are on the DMO side. Like, I know there's burning issues or things that are frustrating you. Would love to have you reach out to me and tell me what those are. We've got a couple of really good ones coming up in the next few weeks, and I think people are going to enjoy it. But I would love to really hear what are the problems. Let's have a conversation and discourse around them, and hopefully, we'll all be better tomorrow than we were today. So, until next time, this has been Destination Discourse.
Thanks, everybody. It's almost like we know what we're talking about.
Nah, I wouldn't go that far.